The following workshop was recorded at the 7th Annual Pittsburgh Classical Christian Education Conference. For more information about the conference, visit the Blackburn Study Center website at www.blackburnstudycenter.org.
Well, good morning. Still officially morning out here. I'm Jay Weil, and the title of this talk is The Bible, a Great Source of Modern Science. I want to first let you know that there are handouts available, but in a shameless attempt to get you to go to our website, they aren't here. They're on our website. So you go to apologia.com. There's a bunch of things you click on the left-hand side. One of them is handouts, and then you can find the title of this talk under the convention listing for Pittsburgh. So all of the facts that are on this on these slides, not the pretty pictures, but at least the words and so forth, are all available there. So don't feel like you have to be a scribe and writing all this down. If you find something you're interested in, it is there. And, you know, when you're there, you might as well shop a little, right? to let you know a little bit about who I am, just so you know where I'm coming from on this, I have a PhD in everyone's favorite subject, nuclear chemistry. I was a university professor for far too long. Started out at Indiana University. And if you know college basketball at all, let me assure you that I never choked any of my students when I was on faculty, like some of the other faculty members have been accused of doing. I was at Indiana University and then transferred to Ball State University, which is another university in the Indiana state system. While you're a professor, you need to expand the academic knowledge in your field, which is really code word for spend taxpayer money. And so I spent your taxpayer money through the National Science Foundation, which funds nuclear chemistry research, and I'd like to thank each and every one of you for your contributions in helping me study things that really you couldn't care less about. I've published over 30 articles in the nationally recognized peer-reviewed journals of my field, which, of course, no one reads. Science these days is so focused that if you write an article for most scientific journals, maybe 20 people across the world will read it. So they're there collecting dust. Nowadays, what I do is I write textbooks that students are forced to read. So that works out much better for me. I have a lot more people reading my work now because they have to. So that's kind of nice. So just the main point here is that I am trained in science. I am a practicing science, whatever that means. And I know the process of science because I've spent a lot of your money to produce articles that nobody reads. What we're talking about today is the Bible is a great source of modern science. And if you think about it, the Bible actually should have a lot of science in it. Because after all, it was written by the one who designed and built everything. So he's obviously got a lot of knowledge there. He's got more knowledge than any other being is going to have. He's going to have a lot more knowledge, certainly, than any scientist. So the author knows nature's secrets. The author also speaks about nature quite a bit. And I don't know if you've ever had the privilege of talking to someone who's actually designed and built something on his or her own. If you get that person to start talking about his or her invention, you will find that they'll go on and on about it, and they'll generally, as they talk about their invention, they'll generally impart some secrets to you. Obviously not trade secrets and things like that, but they generally will talk to you about, oh, here's how I fixed this problem, here's how I fixed that problem. Since the one who authored nature also speaks about nature quite a bit in the Bible, you would just expect, much like any other designer would tend to impart wisdom and knowledge about his design to you, you would expect the author of the Bible to do the same thing. And what we found is this is really true, because as man has muddled through history, and in many times it really is muddled through history, he has found that the Bible contains a wealth of scientific knowledge. Unfortunately, as is typical with human beings, we never really paid attention until after we learned it ourselves. Much like your children often don't pay as much attention to you until they mess up on their own. In the same way, we have sort of ignored a lot about what the Bible says about science simply because we needed to figure it out on our own and we thought we were the only ones who could do it. But as we've learned things about science, we found there's an enormous amount of scientific knowledge in the Bible. And I just want to go through some of these things that the Bible contains that are really quite amazing. Now, you know, in the Old Testament, the Jewish culture was surrounded by a lot of other cultures. And the cultures that surrounded the Jews all had ideas of how the earth was supported. They thought that the earth had to actually rest on something. And so, for example, in Greek mythology, you have Titans. They're supposed to be holding up the earth. Not all that long ago, I was watching a videotape of a Charles Kuralt special where he was interviewing people, the Flat Earth Society. And he was asking these folks in the Flat Earth Society, how does the earth hang in space? And the woman who was speaking for them, I suppose, said, well, you know, it sits on the back of a big turtle. And he says, well, how does the turtle stay in space? And she said, well, each of its paws is on the back of a smaller turtle. And he said, okay, so what's those smaller turtles standing on? And she said, you know, I see where you're going with this, and I have to tell you, it's turtles all the way down. And you know, when we do science, one thing we have to realize is science doesn't always conform to common sense. Common sense says if the earth is out there in space, it ought to be sitting on something. That's what common sense back in these times said before we knew about things like gravity and so forth and how the sun keeps the earth in its orbit and such. We thought it only makes sense. You know, if something wants to hang out, you know, in the air, it has to sit on something. So common sense tells us the earth has to sit on something. And that's why cultures around the Old Testament had all different ideas of what the earth sat on. The Bible's always been very clear about this, however. In Job 26:7, for example, we read, he stretches out the north over empty space and hangs the earth on nothing. Now, to you and me, this is just, of course. We know, we've seen pictures of the earth out there in space, and it is, in fact, hanging on nothing. But at this point in history, and you know, really even up until Sir Isaac Newton, this was a revolutionary idea. The very idea that something could hang somewhere without resting on or being suspended from something was revolutionary. But the Bible has always said, nope, there aren't titans, there aren't turtles. It's just hanging out there on nothing. A lot of scientists, even up to the late 1400s in some cases, thought the earth was flat. And once again, this is common sense, isn't it? I walk across here, and except for hills and everything, everything looks flat. I stand in a cornfield, it looks flat. It makes sense then that the earth is flat, right? That's common sense. Of course, common sense is overruled by the idea that if the curve is very, very large and the radius of curvature is very, very large, then in any given observable place, that radius of curvature can't be noticed. And in the end, a circle can look flat if its radius is big enough. And so scientists for a long time thought the earth was flat, even up until the late 1400s. But the Bible's never said that. In fact, the Bible says just the opposite. In Job 26:10, he has inscribed a circle on the surface of the water at the boundaries of light and darkness. So there is a circle between the boundaries of light and darkness, between the earth and space. It is he who sits above the circle of the earth. So in the end, the Bible's always told us there's no flatness to the earth. It's been round. And this is, you know, one of the interesting things that you come across in modern day people who don't know a lot about creationist views or don't know a lot about science in general. A lot of times they'll say, you know, creationists are like the flat earthers. Well, in fact, creationists have always believed the Bible, and the Bible's never said the earth is flat. In fact, the Bible was the first to get it right, that the earth is not flat. In fact, the Bible was the first to describe the hydrologic cycle. If you're unfortunate enough to have to use my textbooks at some point, in physical science and a little bit in biology, you'll learn all about the hydrologic cycle, the way water is cycled throughout creation. It was first really described in the Bible. Job 36:27-28 says, "For he draws up the drops of water, they distill rain from the mist, which the clouds pour down, they drip on man abundantly." Okay, that's only the first step in the hydrological cycle. That's evaporation and precipitation. Ecclesiastes fills in the rest. "All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they return again." Now, once again, this makes complete sense to us with our scientific knowledge of the day. But think about how revolutionary this was during Old Testament and even New Testament times. The very idea that somehow the water that's in the ocean gets back to the river. How does it do that? How does it get back to the river? Well, nowadays we know how it gets back to the river. In the ocean or in the bodies of water, water evaporates, becomes clouds. The clouds eventually rain or snow down. That's precipitation. So if I got water from the sea forming a cloud, that cloud then travels over to the ocean. When it distills, when it rains down, that rain will end up in a river or a lake or groundwater or something like that. So the hydrological cycle is a very detailed process by which God recycles the water on the planet so that we don't have a situation where the sea gets full and the rivers get empty. In the end, we have a continual flow between the sea as the major reservoir of water and the other freshwater sources that we typically use. Now, once again, this kind of idea was revolutionary back in the time of the Old and New Testament, and in fact, scientists didn't figure out the hydrological cycle until the early 1600s. It took man all that time to figure out the hydrological cycle, which is basically already explained in the Bible. Think about how much time we would have saved if we'd have just went to the textbook first. Speaking of water, you may be surprised to find out that the Bible gives us the first example of water softening. I don't know if you have a water softener. I live in Indiana, which is all limestone. And if you live in limestone, either you have a water softener or you have really stringy hair and really rotten-tasting water. So we have a water softener. But what a water softener does is it does not take things out and make the water pure. That's a very difficult process that costs way too much money to do it on a regular basis. What a water softener does is it exchanges one thing dissolved in the water for something else. In Indiana, the thing we want to get rid of in the water is calcium. Calcium is an ion that comes from limestone. As water rushes over limestone, it picks up a few calcium ions. Calcium ions tend to precipitate out of solution very easily, and that's what makes the stains on your toilet. It also tastes pretty lousy to us. It's absolutely necessary for us, but just doesn't taste very well. It's better to get it in the form of milk or something for our taste buds. Calcium is absolutely necessary, not only for our bones, but believe it or not, for our muscles. Without calcium, our muscles wouldn't work. So calcium is necessary, but it's not tasty. And so in water, we'd rather not have it there. The problem with removing the calcium ions is that's very hard. So what we choose to do instead is replace those calcium ions with something that's more tasty and doesn't precipitate out of water very much, so it doesn't make stains. What we replace the calcium with is either sodium or potassium. When you buy salt for your water softener, what you're doing is buying a source of sodium or potassium ions, depending on what kind of salt you buy. Those ions end up replacing the calcium ions in the water, and that's what water softening is. Well, in the Bible, we read about when Moses was leading the children of Israel. The children of Israel, of course, continued to complain about many things. And at one time, they were complaining about the fact they didn't have any water to drink. And the problem was, there was a lot of water around where they were, but unfortunately, it was what the Bible calls bitter. Now, bitter water just means you can't drink it. It's a lot like seawater. You can't drink it. It may not be seawater, but it's something that you can't drink because either of the taste or toxic stuff in there. So Moses cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. He threw the tree into the waters, and the waters became sweet. And by sweet, we now mean drinkable. Doesn't mean it necessarily tasted sweet. It just means it's drinkable now. And it turns out that this could have certainly been a miracle, there's no question about it, or this could have simply been water softening. Because the way water softening works, like I said, is you simply exchange one ion for another. In order for this exchange to occur, there has to be a membrane over which the ions can travel, and one of the best membranes you can use is cellulose. Cellulose also happens to be the main component in a tree. A tree also reserves a lot of sodium ions in it. So in the end, it's very possible that this tree had just the right kind of cellulose layer, had the right level of sodium, and ion exchange occurred across the tree. Now, like I said, this could have been a miracle, but nevertheless, it's interesting to see that whether it was a miracle or whether it was natural, this is really the first recorded event of turning bad water into good water. The Bible knows that air has mass. One of the experiments you do in our courses is you demonstrate that air has mass. But the idea that air actually weighs something was rather revolutionary for a long, long time. Because it doesn't feel like air weighs anything. And once again, we're now back to this common sense idea. As I'm moving through the air, I certainly don't feel any weight. So as a result, common sense tells me air doesn't have mass. It doesn't have weight. But in fact, it does. Job 28:25 specifically says that, when he imparted weight to the wind and meted out the water by measure. So he gave weight to the wind. And in fact, this was finally discovered in 1640. It took human science until 1640 to really show that air had weight. And Evangelista Torricelli, who's done a lot of wonderful stuff, mostly around electricity, but in this case atmospheric stuff, showed that air had mass. He showed that if you have a column of mercury and you evacuate one side of it, the amount of air on the other side will push that column of mercury up. And this is, of course, what we use today to measure air pressure. We call it a barometer. Torricelli was the first one to show or to demonstrate a barometer and demonstrate using it that air indeed had mass. He was the first to demonstrate it, but the author of nature told his creation already that it was there. One of the most interesting stories about how man finally discovered something that was in the Bible comes from Matthew Maury. Now, probably up until the 1800s anyway, or at least maybe the 1850s, Matthew Maury was a household name. Everybody knew who this guy was because he revolutionized the world. He truly did, and you'll see why in a minute. And in order to revolutionize the world, he had to go to the Bible to get his inspiration. He was sick, and he was a devoted Christian. While he was sick and in bed, he read the Bible quite a bit. And while reading Psalm 8:3-8, he noticed something that in a million readings I would have never noticed. Here's Psalm 8:3-8. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You made him ruler over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet, all flocks and herds and the beasts of the field, the birds of the air and the fish of the sea and all that swim in the paths of the sea. Now, Matthew Maury had read this several times before, but while you're in bed and don't have anything else to do, you tend to think a little more deeply. And so in the end, he actually thought about what, especially this last verse, the part I put in blue, is saying. He believed, and according to his diary, he actually said, the author of nature wrote this book. And I believe that he showed his words very carefully. So I think every word in the Bible is true and means something. And so when God says that birds that fish swim in the paths of the sea, that told him there are paths in the sea. Now, what specifically spoke to him about this is he was a navigator for the U.S. Navy. It was his job to get boats from one part of the ocean to the other. Now, he thought, you know, if I'm walking through a forest, if I'm small enough, I can weave through all the trees and eventually get to the other edge of the forest. But it's much quicker and much safer if I follow a path through the forest. If there are truly paths in the sea, then I should be directing boats along them. Because just like a path in the forest is going to make the forest easier to cross, a path in the sea is going to make the sea easier to cross. Now, of course, you know, much like Job, as he was sick, he had friends visiting him. He would tell his friends about this. And his friends, of course, made fun of him. What in the world do you mean, paths in the sea? I think you're taking the Bible a little too literally here. The sea is just a heaving mass of water. How in the world can there be a path on it? And he said, I don't know, but the Bible says it's there. So I ought to find it. And he actually wrote in his diary, if I ever get out of this bed, because remember he was sick, if I ever get out of this bed, I'm going to find those paths. And in fact, he did get better, and he did find those pathways. You know what he found? Today we call them the shipping lanes. It turns out there are prevailing currents in the ocean. If your ship is sitting on one of those prevailing currents and going in the right direction, it can travel as much as 10 times faster than if it's off that prevailing current. And good enough for us, these prevailing currents connect one continent to another. So here we're looking at the Earth sort of from the top down. These prevailing currents really allow you to go from one continent to the other side of the continent or from one continent to another continent. This revolutionized sea travel. Before Matthew Maury discovered his pathways in the sea, people would spend months just trying to get from one continent to another. Months now became weeks and sometimes just a collection of days when you traveled along one of the sea's paths. So Matthew Maury was in fact the very first scientist who made the earth smaller. He was the very first scientist who made it possible for people to get from one part of the earth to another significantly more quickly. As a result, intercontinental trade, intercontinental communication, all of that quickly got better as a result of Matthew Maury believing that every word in the Bible is true. If you go to Richmond, Virginia, which is his hometown, you'll find several monuments, but there's a sort of a street in Richmond that's called like Monument Lane or something like that, and there are all sorts of monuments on it. And there's a monument to Matthew Maury there, and the inscription reads, Matthew Fontaine Maury, Pathfinder of the Seas, the genius who first snatched from the ocean and the atmosphere the secret of their laws. His inspiration, Holy Writ, Psalm 8, verse 8, Psalm 107, 23 through 24, and Ecclesiastes 1, 6. So in the end, this is not only an example of how the Bible contains science, but it's also an example of how you and I ought to read the Bible. I mean, Matthew Maury looked at one word. He believed the Bible enough to realize that one word meant something important. If that one word can make the earth smaller, then maybe one word in your devotion tonight can make a big difference in your life if you're willing to look at the Bible that way. Bible also knows about one of the most difficult concepts in science. It's one of the founding concepts of science, but it's also one of the most difficult, thermodynamics. In my high school curriculum, depending on what courses you take, you might spend as much as a month studying thermodynamics. And thermodynamics is not only one of the most difficult subjects to learn, it is also one of the most misunderstood, even by scientists. Typically, if a scientist doesn't actually do thermodynamic calculations as a part of his or her research, he or she doesn't really understand the depths of thermodynamics. You have to work and work with thermodynamics to truly understand it. However, the Bible talked about it long before anything else. Psalm 102, 26 says, "In the beginning you laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. They will all wear out like a garment. Like clothing you will change them, and they will be discarded." This is a very accurate description on the universal scale of the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics states that the first law of thermodynamics, which isn't contained here, but you need to know first, the first law says there's only a certain amount of energy in the universe. That energy can exchange forms, can go from one form to another, but you can't create or destroy it. There's just a certain energy content and that's it. The second law of thermodynamics says the amount of energy available to do work in the universe is constantly decreasing. As a result, everything wears out like a garment over time. Whether it's a planet, whether it's a galaxy, whether it's a fish, whether in fact it's a protein molecule, everything wears out over time. That is one of the fundamental doctrines of science these days. Of course, it was completely unknown to science until the 1800s. So this fundamental doctrine of science today was completely unknown except in the Bible. A fellow by the name of Rudolf Clausius actually derived this second law of thermodynamics mathematically in 1850. He actually said, assuming the first law of thermodynamics and assuming these physical equations that have been verified by lots and lots of experiments, here's a natural result of these equations that everything wears out. Now, people didn't believe that you could take physics equations and make predictions about the future that way. So in the end, he was attacked for a long, long time on this. His views were attacked, and he actually died before they became prominent in the scientific community at all. However, very, very careful experiments over several years showed that, in fact, Rudolf Clausius was right, over time things wear out. Now, it's very important to know that until the late 1800s, this was not the view of scientists. The view of scientists was quite the opposite. The view of scientists was the reason a garment wears out is because moths eat it, or bacteria get in it, or something consumes it. However, there's nothing that consumes a planet, so a planet's going to be there forever. There's nothing that consumes the sun, so the sun's going to be there forever. The idea that the sun, the planets, the universe as a whole could somehow wear out was simply not possible in the framework of science up until Rudolf Clausius derived the second law and then subsequent experiments showed it to be correct. Nevertheless, the Bible has always talked about the second law of thermodynamics. As Dwayne Gish says, many years of careful measurements by scientists repeated many thousands of times established beyond doubt the scientific truths expressed in this verse of Scripture. Now, I want to take a brief departure here, a brief pause, and explain to you, if you're a creationist and you listen to creationist literature, like many other non-creationist scientists, creationists often get the second law of thermodynamics wrong. And once again, this is mostly because the thermodynamics is a very difficult science to understand, and unless you actually work with it regularly, it's awfully hard to get all the nuances. There are creationists that say the second law of thermodynamics forbids evolution. That is false. The second law of thermodynamics can say nothing about evolution. Second law of thermodynamics can talk about one thing and one thing only, the universe as a whole. That's all the second law can say. The second law says that over time, the universe always becomes more disordered. The universe wears out. Now, as a subsequent result, the planets and everything will eventually wear out. They have to wear out for the universe to wear out. However, there are times when things actually become better. Even when things become better, however, the universe as a whole becomes more disordered. For example, if I leave a pot of water out in a cold, on a cold day, it will freeze. It turns out when water freezes, it becomes more ordered. It actually apparently violates the second law of thermodynamics because rather than wearing out, it actually becomes more structured. However, it doesn't violate the second law of thermodynamics because when water freezes, it has to give up something. It has to give up energy. And guess where it gives it to? It gives it to its surroundings. In order for water to freeze, each molecule has to give up a little energy. We call that the latent heat of fusion. And when that heat is transferred to the surroundings, it makes the surroundings wear out. So in the end, if you sum up the entire universe, being both the ice and its surroundings, you will find that the total change in the universe is wearing out a little bit. Because water wears out its surroundings more than it becomes more structured. And in fact, that's actually what determines the fact that water freezes at 32 degrees and not 35 or 40. At the point at which water disorders its surroundings more by releasing its heat than the water itself gets ordered by freezing, that's the point where freezing is allowed. Because that's the point at which the second law of thermodynamics allows things to happen. So just as a brief aside, if you hear the second law of thermodynamics violates evolution, that is not true. The second law of thermodynamics merely says every time a beneficial mutation happens, that beneficial mutation must disorder the surroundings more than the genetics are ordered. That's all that second law of thermodynamics says about evolution. Okay, the Bible knows an enormous amount about modern medicine. It's truly amazing how much modern medicine you can find in the Bible. Did you think you'd learn about circumcision today? Yeah, guys will get a little nervous here. So circumcision is discussed in Genesis 17, 10 through 12, and it's described that it needs to happen on the eighth day of life. Now, of course, you read the writings of some of the cultures around the Jews in Old Testament and New Testament times, and they learn about this ritual called circumcision, and these cultures that don't understand the significance of it say, "Why in the world would you do that to your little baby?" But in fact, the Jews all did it because God told them to in Genesis 10 through 12, 17, 10 through 12. Now, of course, the Jews did it simply because God told them to, but it turned out it was incredibly beneficial for them to do that. In the late 40s, a study was done of more than 86,000 women in the Boston, Massachusetts area. They were actually looking for something else. But one thing they noticed, that the Jewish women are 8.5 times less likely to contract cervical cancer than non-Jewish women. 8.5 times, 850%. This is a huge number. In medical science, this is a huge number. You keep your cholesterol low, you may reduce your risk of heart attack by 30%. 1.3 times. This is 8.5 times. This is huge. So, of course, as soon as this number came out, the scientists, well, is it valid? And if it's valid, what in the world are Jewish women doing to protect themselves from cervical cancer? Because cervical cancer is a killer disease. Still kills millions of women across the world, not so much in the U.S. anymore, but across the world. Well, they did follow-up studies. And the follow-up studies, even though they didn't know what was causing cervical cancer at the time, the follow-up studies said the only thing we can find that's different between the Jewish women and everybody else. They looked at things like diet and exercise, all those things you normally think of. They said, you know, these folks, these Jewish women are mostly married to circumcised men. And perhaps this means there's something on men that's causing cervical cancer in women. And in fact, many years of research later, we found out that's exactly true. The cervical cancer is actually a sexually transmitted disease. It's caused by a virus called the human papillomavirus. And although there are ways of getting it besides intercourse, the most likely way to get it is intercourse. And as a result, they theorized that circumcised men keep themselves cleaner. Now, I got to tell you, it's been fashionable these days to claim that circumcision is not the result of the fact that Jewish women are so protected against cervical cancer. However, these folks who say this is true can't show a study to back up their claims. And in fact, there are a lot of studies that show just the opposite. The latest study I found was done in 2002, April 11th. That's fairly recent. What it did was it actually measured circumcised men and uncircumcised men and looked for human papillomavirus, the virus that causes cervical cancer. It found that the human papillomavirus is 3 times more prevalent in non-circumcised men as compared to circumcised men. So there's a direct link. Now, it's important to realize that these studies are not done in the U.S. anymore because the U.S. has an incredible hygiene compared to the rest of the world. And basically, circumcision is a way of keeping yourself clean. In the U.S., we bathe so much, we have so much, soaps and things like that that we use, that in the end, in the U.S. anymore, circumcision's not a big deal. I don't think you really need to do it in the U.S. anymore just because of our hygienics. But if you go to other countries where people shower and bathe once a week, things like that, and then, you know, when I was in high school, that's what my health book told me to do. My health book told me to bathe once a week. But you go to countries where that's still the practice, and you'll find results like this. So we know for certain that circumcision is involved in cervical cancer. Not only do we have these epidemiological studies that show women who have sex with circumcised men are less likely to get cervical cancer, but we also have the direct link. We know that HPV is much more prevalent in non-circumcised men as opposed to circumcised men. Okay, so let me ask you a question. Was Moses just lucky about this? Did he just come up with this bizarre ritual and it happened to protect Jewish women from cervical cancer? Well, you know, I might be willing to believe that, except this part right here. The Bible clearly says that this should happen on the 8th day of life outside the womb. The 8th day. Now, that actually turns out to be an incredibly important day in the development of a person. Because a circumcision is a surgical procedure. Like any surgical procedure, it involves cutting. What happens when you cut flesh? It bleeds. Why doesn't all your blood just rush out that cut? Because your blood is designed to clot. The clotting blood stops up the cut as long as it's not huge, and as a result, you don't lose any more blood. Well, the blood clotting process is a truly amazing thing, but if you look at 2 of the big players in the blood clotting process, they're vitamin K and prothrombin. If you're older and you go to the doctor to get ProTime tests, what they're doing is measuring your prothrombin level to make sure your blood clots properly. Now, when you are born, you have actually no vitamin K in your body. However, you take a big breath, and when you take that big breath, your first big breath, you breathe in all sorts of bacterial spores. That sounds really rotten, but in fact, those bacterial spores are good for you. They end up inhabiting your intestines, where they chew on things that you aren't really all that interested in digesting. And since you're providing them with food and housing, they want to provide you with something in return. They provide you with vitamin K. And so as soon as you take your first breath, those bacteria germinate. They start making vitamin K for you. And on about the 6th day of your life, you have all the vitamin K you're going to need in your system. The interesting thing here is prothrombin. When you're born, you have 90% of the prothrombin you need for good blood clotting. However, because of some biochemical inconsistencies between you and your mother, you actually start losing the prothrombin over time. This is the way it happens for natural childbirth. For cesarean, it's not quite this big because you don't have as much contact with your mother's blood. But in any event, natural childbirth, over the first few days, you actually lose a lot of prothrombin. About your 4th day of life, your body notices this and decides, you know, I got to start making prothrombin. So it starts kicking those prothrombin-making mechanisms into overdrive. And by your 7th day, you're at normal levels, but your body can't stop right away. On your eighth day of life, you actually have 110% of the normal levels of prothrombin. So if there's any day of your life you should be cut, it's your eighth day, because that's when your blood's going to clot better than any other time. Now, let me make it clear to you, Moses didn't know anything about human papillomavirus, didn't know anything about cervical cancer, didn't know anything about prothrombin and vitamin K. In fact, in his day, the way you healed a cut was you packed it with fly feces. And people, doctors raised flies so that they could have a lot of feces to stick in people's cuts. So that's the level of medical knowledge he was working with, all right? Nevertheless, in the Old Testament, it's prescribed a bizarre ritual, seemingly bizarre ritual, that not only protects Jewish women against cervical cancer, but it also prescribes it on medically the very best day of your life for it to be done. One of the most interesting studies about science in the Bible comes from how science knew about germs, especially if you compare it to how people learned about germs. Most people think that we learned about germs when the microscope was invented. That's not really true. When the microscope was invented by Antonin van Leeuwenhoek, that was like in the 1600s, 1700s, something like that. I'm not sure exactly when, but it was in that order of time. He saw all these squiggly things under his microscope, but he had no reason to think they were harmful to us. After all, we're big, they're small. What can they do to us? He actually called it God's miniature creation. And he thought that these things he was seeing in the microscope were just sort of miniature versions of, dogs and cats and stuff like that. Nothing that could hurt you. So in the end, we knew about microscopic organisms long before we knew that some of them can be pretty bad for you. Nevertheless, the Bible commands things that tells us specifically about germs. For example, the Bible commands Jews to dig outhouses. Here's what Deuteronomy says. You shall set off a plate outside the camp. And when you go out, and you shall have an implement among your equipment, and when you sit down outside. Now, you know what that means, right? That's a good way of saying going to the bathroom. When you sit down outside, you shall dig with it, the implement, and turn and cover your refuse. So this is a command for Jewish people to do that stuff outside of the camp. Now, please understand, this was a revolutionary idea. No one else did this. Only the Jews did it because they were commanded to. In fact, if you were in any other culture, when it was time nature called, you simply relieved yourself wherever you happened to be. Usually it was just on the street. Now, if you were wealthy, you relieved yourself in a chamber's pot, which then got thrown out into the street. But in the end, all that stuff ended up out on the street. And of course, this was, a hay bed for cholera, dysentery, typhoid fever, and all of that. However, had people simply followed God's rule about where to relieve yourself when nature calls, they wouldn't have been nearly as much cholera, dysentery, and typhoid fever in the history of people, because in the end, they wouldn't have been making their towns and cities a breeding ground for these bacteria and fungi. Arturo Castiglione is a medical historian, and he talks about this particular commandment, saying it is a primitive measure, but an effective one, which indicates advanced ideas of sanitation. Where do you think those advanced ideas came from? The Bible was the first to document doing a quarantine. Leviticus 13 discusses the diagnosis of leprosy. It's very important to understand leprosy in the Bible is not leprosy today. What we call leprosy today is something completely different. Leprosy in the Bible was actually a whole host of skin diseases. Leprosy today is a nerve condition. So it's different things, and that's common. The King James Bible, for example, talks about corn. But corn wasn't around in that part of the world at that time. It's talking really about grain. But in any event, Leviticus 13 discusses the diagnosis of what was called leprosy back then. It involves several detailed diagnosis techniques. And if the person is determined to be a leper, quote, he shall remain unclean all the days during which he has the infection. He is unclean. He shall live alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp. So basically what they're saying is, take someone with an infectious skin disease and remove them from the rest of the people. Makes perfect sense to you and me, right? However, once again, revolutionary for its time. You see, back then, they didn't believe you could catch diseases from people. They believed diseases were the wrath of the gods or God. And in the end, you didn't catch diseases. Diseases weren't communicable. If a whole group of people got diseases, because God was mad at all of them. So in the end, the very idea of simply separating out the sick people revolutionary. Once again, Arturo Castiglione, the laws against leprosy in Leviticus 13 may be regarded as the first model of a sanitary legislation. In the end, the Bible's modeling for us what we ought to be doing in terms of health. I want to explain to you how man figured out that germs can be bad for you, because it's truly incredible. Remember at the beginning I said that as man has muddled through history, oh, there's been a lot of muddling in science. And so in the end, this is a good example of exactly how man muddled through things. I have to see when I'm supposed to stop. Okay, good. Here's how man muddled through things. There's a fellow by the name of Semmelweis. He was a Hungarian doctor in the 1840s. He was put in charge of a ward in a very famous hospital in Vienna. And he noticed that in his ward, patients were dying a lot more quickly than the other wards. And his ward was the maternity ward. And even though childbirth was dangerous back then, it shouldn't be as dangerous as, for example, the people coming in with other diseases, with the diseases and so forth. So in the end, he decided there's something wrong here. Childbirth is dangerous, but should not be killing women at the rate that I'm seeing it in my ward. So he decided he'd do a study to figure out, you know, what is it that's causing women to die in my ward? He said he finally determined that the only noticeable difference with his ward and the other wards in the hospital was his ward was the first stop that the doctors and students made after performing autopsies on the dead. They'd go to the morgue first, open up those dead bodies, try and learn from them and figure out what killed them, and then they'd come and do pelvic exams and so forth for the women and deliver babies and such. Well, Semmelweis hypothesized, if you will, that the doctors were carrying something bad from the corpses to the women. And that's why his women were dying so much. So he decided, good idea to get them to stop carrying whatever they're carrying. He didn't know what they were carrying. It was just a hypothesis. So he developed a way to test his hypothesis. He simply said, and this will just shock you, before coming and performing pelvic exams and delivering babies, why don't you wash your hands first? Now, once again, pure common sense to us. But back then, they had no idea that dirt, grime, blood could carry bad things. So in the end, if a doctor was digging in his garden and then had to go perform a surgery, he wouldn't even bother to get the dirt underneath his fingernails off his fingernails. If they were performing autopsies in the dead, obviously they'd wipe their hands dry just so that it wasn't, you know, dripping. But they wouldn't bother to scrub them clean. Well, Semmelweis said, why don't you do that? We're going to put a basin out here, and you're going to wash your hands before you enter my ward. Okay, well, with the new world, the doctors didn't like it because, you know, it takes away from time from the golf course if you have to actually wash your hands. But they grudgingly obeyed it, and the Dr. Semmelweis' death rates decreased to the lowest in the hospital. So the ward that was once the highest death rate in the hospital becomes now the lowest. You'd think the doctors would be happy about that, right? No. They were so annoyed with Dr. Semmelweis for making them wash their hands that they eventually got the head of the hospital to fire him. His replacement, who was very eager to please these doctors, rescinded Semmelweis' policy, and the death rates in the ward shot right back up again. So it was clear to Semmelweis what was going on. Unfortunately, no one believed him. He spent the rest of his life doing experiments to confirm there's something bad in dead people and you need to wash your hands before you go to surgery. He actually died in an insane asylum because no one had listened to him. And he knew people were dying because no one would listen to him. And it ate at him so much that he eventually died in an insane asylum. Of course, nowadays we do know, you know, there are germs. Many germs are benign, but many germs are pathogenic. So you have to clean yourself meticulously before you do surgeries, especially after you contact something that's dead because it's had all this time to decompose and so forth. If you look at the Bible gives you strict regulations about what to do if you happen to contact a dead body. It says you have to wash your hands. You have to repeatedly wash your hands in running water. So we don't want, you know, these germs just to pile up and start culturing in some stagnant bath water. We have to actually do running water to get those germs out of the way. You have to have intervals of drying and exposure to the sun. Guess what the sun does? It provides ultraviolet radiation, which will kill the bacteria you couldn't get off with the soap. If you actually look at the soap that Numbers 19 tells you you're supposed to use to do these washings with, You'll see that it's made by burning together a young cow to get oil, cedar wood, hyssop branches, scarlet wool. The cedar wood oil is an irritant that encourages you to scrub. You know, you're scratching because it's irritating you. Hyssop oil kills bacteria. It's an antiseptic. And a scrubbing element, wool fibers, that causes these bacteria that are lodged onto your skin. A lot of bacteria have this thing called a capsule that actually sticks to your skin. So you really have to scrub them off. All of these things were a part of the soap that Numbers 19 says you're supposed to wash with. Today, hospitals use this very similar soap. Obviously not with these ingredients, but they contain the same thing. They contain an irritant, an antiseptic, and a scrubbing element. As S.I. McMillan, who's another historian of science, says, he's actually a medical doctor who's a turned historian. At long last, he talks about, you know, this Semmelweis issue. At long last, man finally muddled through. He learned, after centuries and at a frightful cost, what God gave to Moses by inspiration. Had doctors simply performed the procedure that the Bible says to perform after you've contacted the dead body, lots and lots of people would not have died. I think I'm closing with this. Yes, I think so. The Bible also knows that the universe is expanding. The Bible says, it is God who removes the mountains, that's erosion, and they know not how, when he overturns them in his anger, that's an earthquake, who shakes the earth out of its place, earthquake, its pillars tremble, who commands the sun not to shine, and sets a seal upon the stars, who alone stretches out the heavens and tramples down the waves of the sea. Stretches out the heavens. Now, people who know a lot more Hebrew than I do say that if you actually look at that word stretches, it actually not only means he at one time did it, it means he's continually doing it, that he is continually stretching out the heavens. Another verse in Psalm 104, 1-2, bless the Lord, O my soul, Lord my God, you are very great, you are clothed with splendor and majesty, covering yourself with light as with a cloak, stretching out the heaven like a tent curtain. Now, most astronomers today believe that the universe is indeed expanding. We can look at light coming from distant stars, and this light coming from distant stars seems to be shifted in such a way that the only way to explain it is that space itself is stretching. So when light is released from the star, and as it's traveling, as space stretches, the light gets stretched, and that makes its wavelengths longer. This is called a red shift because the longer light wavelengths are in the visible spectrum, the more red they become. So in the end, when we look at distant stars, we see the light is shifted heavily towards the red. If we look at less distant stars, it's shifted but not as much to the red. The farther the stars are away, the more the light is shifted to the red. This implies that the longer it takes for the light to get to our planet, the more time the universe has had to expand, so the more the stretching will occur. So it makes perfectly sense then that the universe is actually expanding. There's a little new research out there. It's so new it's not clear that it's completely reliable or not, but astrophysicists have really jumped on it, that the expansion of the universe is actually accelerating. For a long time we thought it should be slowing down because gravity ought to be pulling everything towards itself and therefore slowly stopping the universe. But some of the latest data, and this has been about 7 years now that astrophysicists have been seeing this, it almost seems like the universe's expansion is getting faster over time. This is a very interesting phenomenon that no one really understands, and so it's a very active research in astrophysics. But the point here is, long before astrophysicists talked about an expanding universe, the Bible talked about an expanding universe. So I've left a little bit of time for questions, because questions are always a good thing, but the first one's always the hardest. Anyone want to ask a question? I'll repeat it so that everybody can hear it. Yes, sir.
You said earlier that the second law of thermodynamics
Right.
But doesn't it make evolution less likely?
Oh, absolutely.
Because the evolutionists believe that a disorderly universe, perhaps a big bang,
Right. So the question is, you know, the second law of thermodynamics doesn't disprove evolution. Does it make it less likely? Yes, that's certainly true because it provides a stricture. What am I trying to say? A constraint on evolution. Not any old mutation can make your genetics more advanced. it's got to be a mutation that somehow disorders the universe even more. To this day, nobody's got a viable mechanism by how that can happen, so one could argue that no one has explained how evolution is consistent with the second law. Doesn't mean second law has disproved it, however. Now, to your point that the Big Bang was a lot of disorder that then ordered itself into a universe, that's not necessarily clear. I mean, in the models of the Big Bang, when the point singularity occurs, that, you know, all the matter goes one way, all the antimatter goes the other, so now we have a universe, and then there's this antimatter out there somewhere that's maybe making some anti-universe or something like that. That's actually a big increase in order. Because before the Big Bang started, according to Big Bangers, the space was a sea of a perfect mixture of matter and antimatter. Now that's total disorder, all right? But because of the way probability works, at some point you can have all the atoms in this podium could suddenly decide to move one way and the podium would jump. If in fact all the antimatter decided to move one way, all the matter decided to move another, at that point you have a very, very ordered system. And after that, everything's becoming more disordered. All right? Now, what we see as order, you know, we see clumps of galaxies and planets and so forth, and that's islands of order in a sea of disorder. But in the end, the universe actually started in the Big Bang purely ordered. Now, the question is, if we go from the sea of matter and antimatter to that purely ordered system, how did that happen? That tends to disagree with the second law, and the typical out for that is that's an invalid question, because the laws of physics and chemistry work in the universe, not before. So in the end, who knows what things were playing around with the stuff before the universe? And although you might think that's a disingenuous way out, Christians do exactly the same thing, because after all, we say God made things. Who made God? That's an invalid question. All right, so in the end, I don't see any difference between a Big Banger saying that and a Christian saying that's an invalid question asking who made God. So, yes, sir. Oh, yeah. Okay, the question first is, what is science? There's a lot of debate on what science is, and honestly, scientists can't agree on what science is. And I'll tell you about that in a second. And then the second part of the question is design, something that science can use. First of all, my PhD advisor and I had completely different views of what science was. In my PhD advisor's view, and in a lot of people's view, this is typically referred to as the German rationalist view, science doesn't have to tell you what's true. It doesn't have to tell you what really happened in the past or really what a cell looks like or what an atom looks like. That's not the job of science. The only job of science is to model the universe effectively. So if I can create a model that predicts all observable data, whether or not that model is a true representation of nature is irrelevant. Science's job is simply to model and predict. And if it can do that perfectly, whether it's a correct model or not is irrelevant. That was my PhD advisor's view. In my view, science is a little stronger than that. Science actually tells us what a cell looks like, what an atom looks like, what happened in the past. Science should be able to tell us truth, you know, not divine truth, but there are natural truths, and science should uncover that. So that's a debate that goes on in science today. And if you believe that the scientist's job is simply to model, then of course you're going to reject anything supernatural because that can't be modeled. If you believe the scientist's result is, or the job is to find what happened and what's happening now, then supernatural things may be a part of that if supernatural things truly are occurring. You know, there are scientists who say, even if a bunch of people went up to the top of a mountain, found Noah's Ark, found footprints from all the creatures, found their fossilized feces and so forth, they still wouldn't believe it. Because in the end, that's a supernatural event that can't be modeled. Therefore, regardless of how much evidence is there for it, it's got to be wrong. Now, because of that, obviously, if we believe in a creator, and any kind of creator, be it a god or just an intelligent alien that happens to be doing a big organic chemistry experiment or something like that, then in the end, a scientist, those kinds of scientists aren't going to want to deal with that because it's not modelable. Now, your second question is, and until we figure out, does design model or search for the truth, or does science model or search for the truth, I can't then tell you what's a valid scientific question? All right. Now, into your second question, can science use design? The answer is science already does. For example, just a couple of months ago, I read a paper by two anthropologists who said human beings were in northern England long, 300,000 years before we thought they were. You know why? Not because he found their bones, but because he found stone implements that they had carved, that they had, you know, chiseled and so forth. He found stone tools. And he said these stone tools, and you hold them up, they don't look very impressive, but nevertheless, they have elements of design in them that couldn't have occurred by erosion. And since there are elements of design in these tools, even though there are no bones or anything else of these designers, anthropology says these designed elements means there were designers here. And so the current date for when human beings entered northern Europe is now pushed back by 300,000 years because of design. Okay, so science uses design. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence. It's looking around for radio signals. There are lots of radio signals coming to us, and a lot of them are repeatable and have patterns. However, in order to be communication, it has to be designed to impart information. And what the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is doing is not looking for repeatable signals. It's looking for signals that are designed. And what will it conclude if it finds signals that are designed? It will conclude an intelligence designed those signals to communicate. So yes, science uses design. Unfortunately, because of this issue of modeling, some scientists aren't allowing biologists and astrophysicists and so forth to use those same kind of scientific inferences when it comes to origins. Because if in fact origins are supernatural, whether or not that happened is irrelevant in their view of science because it can't be modeled. That's a great question. And yeah, it's a common current debate now. There are a lot of wrong things said about the intelligent design movement, that it's a cloak for creationism. That isn't true. A lot of creationists don't like the intelligent design movement at all. But the main thing it says is intelligent design doesn't predict things and therefore isn't science. That's absolutely false as well. I'm writing a book for Broadman and Holman, and an entire chapter is going to be devoted to the predictions that intelligent design makes. Intelligent design, for example, predicts that there is little to no junk DNA in an organism's genome. Current science says about 95% of your genome is junk DNA. Intelligent design says something quite different. There are very specific predictions that intelligent design makes that secular science doesn't. And I think that's one way to tell them apart. And in the young Earth, old Earth debate that's going to happen next, I believe, I'm actually going to talk about predictions of young Earth creationism that are confirmed by the data that indicate to me a young Earth, and predictions of old Earth creationism or old Earth views that are denied by the data that indicate there's a problem with old Earth views. So... yes, the debate about what science is truly an issue of either convention or philosophy, something like that. It's not a debate really of science, except that it's asking the definition of. But you can't use scientific methods to decide what science is. That's convention or philosophy or something like that. Yes, one more question. As scientists found the 10th planet, depends on your definition of planet. There is something bigger than Pluto, farther away than Pluto, that is orbiting the sun. There's a belt of objects called the Kuiper belt that contains a lot of asteroids, or the Kuiper belt, I'm sorry, that contains a lot of asteroids. It's thought that Pluto was actually knocked out of the Kuiper belt and became trapped in the sun's orbit. It's also thought that this planet is. If you believe Pluto's a planet, you got to believe this other guy's a planet, because it's bigger, it's also in orbit. Probably has moons, etc. There are a lot of astronomers who don't consider Pluto a planet anymore. They think it was an asteroid that was knocked out of the Kuiper belt. So, depends on your definition of planet. Okay, that's all the time I have. Thank you very much for your excellent question and your kind attention.